Redwood Soundwave.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Zach.
And this is Matt.
And Matt's really sad that I took the introing away from him. This week, we will be discussing the 2017 M. Night Shyamalan hit movie Split, which depicts a unknown character kidnapping three teenage girls and them slowly discovering that their captor struggles with dissociative identity disorder. We get to learn much about his character and the beast within throughout the series of events that unfold in this film. Like I said, M. Night Shyamalan was the writer and director of this movie. This is also the sequel to Unbreakable, and we do get a little Bruce Willis cameo at the end of this movie, and then this leads into Glass. This was my first time seeing this movie. Have you seen this one before?
There we go. I was waiting for you to ask me a question, because whenever I do the intro, I always start with a, so Zach, what do you know? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but I introed, so...
I know. I was waiting to see if you were going to fall into the trap of things that I do.
No, this
yes,
is
yes, I have, of course, seen this movie before. I've seen this movie several times, in fact. My dad and I do like to watch the M. Night Shyamalan films, including The Happening, which is bad. It's a bad
so
movie.
So bad.
Signs, which is a bad. It's a bad movie. The Village, which is middling. It's okay. Lady in the Water is bad.
I like Signs. We know that, though. We've done Signs.
Yeah, you could say that our opinion is...
Split.
Split.
Our opinion is Glass.
Your opinion might be Glass, in that it is easily shattered by truth. And so, this movie, I kind of, you know, going into it now with you, I had already kind of known everything that was going to happen. But for me, that's always really thrilling. I like to see when people come across these movies and the twists that happen. And so, it was a real joy when it gets to this, like, pseudo-paranormal twist that happens near the end of the movie. I was just going to be like, they're going to hate this, and I'm going to be excited about that.
But I liked it to a point.
I know.
And I should say Unbreakable. I'm surprised it took me this long to get around to watching this movie, because Unbreakable is probably one of my favorite movies. Definitely my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie. And I think this film does a good job of building on that, and also like kind of enhancing the meaning and the themes in the first movie at the same time.
In Unbreakable?
Yeah, in Unbreakable. Sorry, shouldn't say
well,
the first
you're
movie.
Not supposed to know, too, that this movie is in the Unbreakable universe. Until the cameo, when the movie first came out, it was completely hushed that, like, this had anything to do with Unbreakable. And you don't really get that it has anything to do with Unbreakable until you see the cameo. The ideas of, like, transcending one's power and becoming more powerful through sheer belief is a, you know, a core theme
right.
in this movie and in Unbreakable. But in this movie, that's not the point of this film. What I hate about this film is the idea that, like, broken is beautiful. Like, that's the whole, like...
Trauma makes you special.
Yeah, trauma makes you special. And it's like, shut up. It's bad. That is a bad theme. The tie into Unbreakable is good. I would have much preferred if they would have left it with the tie into Unbreakable and ended it there.
No, I think that was, although, like, really heavy-handed and kind of, it's the right phrase, like, kind of cheesy. I think that's to be, like, they use the word broken and shatter a lot as, like, kind of buzzwords and to clue you into this being, like, coming out of Unbreakable. Also has to do with Glass. I just want to say Ira Glass, podcaster. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, oh, the broken is beautiful, and we get to know him as mostly Dennis and Barry and, you know, but his actual name is Kevin, correct?
Yes. Okay. We also know Patricia and Hedwig.
Let's just call him Kevin. just to keep things simple for now until we get into the personalities. Kevin's saying, you know, broken is beautiful, and kind of like having this idea and this respect for Casey because he sees like she has been through trauma in her life and then decides to leave her be because of it. I think that's to really kind of put him on the opposite side of the spectrum as Bruce Willis's character, because Bruce Willis's character is the one who cannot be broken, right? Whereas I think they're trying to pit them against each other as, like, you know, Kevin being kind of the super villain who has chosen to use his abilities for nefarious purposes, whereas Bruce Willis's character has obviously chosen the other path.
Yeah, he thinks he's a superhero.
Yeah, he thinks he's a superhero, and Kevin slash Dennis slash the Beast thinks that he's a supervillain, or not
he doesn't think that he's a supervillain. He thinks that he's in the right. He thinks that he is saving them by showing them pain.
Yeah, but that's every villain.
Yeah, but if you're gonna put the perspective through his eyes, he also sees himself as a savior. His intention with his saviorhood takes a fundamentally different form.
Right. Well, to write a good villain, you can't just say they want to be a villain because they want to be evil and they want to, you know, like, it's like the really cheesy line from The Dark Knight. Like, some people just want to watch the world burn. That does not make a good villain.
I disagree.
It makes a scary villain, but...
I disagree. I think that the Joker is a good villain.
You're entitled to your opinion. I don't think it makes a good villain.
You don't think that the Joker's a good villain?
No, I don't. I know, controversial opinion. I think Heath Ledger did a great job in that role, but I don't like the Joker as, like, a villain. I think that this movie, like, it's intriguing, but also somewhat problematic, because whenever you bring DID into the spotlight, you have to be really careful about how you do it, especially if the person with DID is going to be a villain. So how do you think they did?
Bad. I think that they did a bad job. I think that M. Night Shyamalan, that's the big thing. M. Night Shyamalan does not do his research, and then it comes back in a way that can be just kind of extra damaging and extra harmful to communities of people. And I think that in this, it portrayed aspects of DID correctly, but it also portrayed aspects of DID as inherently bad.
Like, you're always going to have, like, the evil persona inside you or something.
Which is largely untrue, because where does DID come from? Well, it specifically comes from trauma during a particular phase of brain formation.
Oftentimes, scientifically, comes from people kind of partitioning certain events with certain personalities. So, what movie is it? I can't think of what movie it is where there's a child.
Identity?
I don't know if I've seen that one.
That's the one that we watched together in your basement that one time where it's the, yes, the little boy is the evil one and he shoves the baseball bat down the guy's throat.
Yes, thank you. We did watch that together. That's a really good one where, you know, he had a traumatic experience as a child. So, you know, he has kind of created this alternate identity for himself, or second identity for himself, that holds that trauma in his past where, you know, he can live on in a separate identity that doesn't suffer from trauma.
The manifestation of everything that we see happens inside of his brain rather than externally. Whereas in Split, everything that we see is wholly externalized.
It's also identity. He only has two identities, whereas this is 24 identities, which, I mean, like...
In identity?
Oh, wait, no, the way he has, like...
He has, like, 15.
It's as many characters as there are in the movie. I forgot. How many is common?
There's a group of TikTokers called the A System, and they have 29.
Oh, wow.
In the case of the A System, I don't know if they have a specific one that is in charge or up front the most, but in this movie, we have Barry. He's the leader. He's typically the one that can hold the light, which is also referred to as the altar, right? They're also called altars, so they come up to the forefront. Hedwig, however, is like the younger innocent one who, in this movie specifically, became the embodiment of that, like, ability to take and pass the light. So he is the one, like, with top-level priority in being able to come to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's as easy, though, based on what I was, like, watching and seeing, for the switches to happen between alters, that instead of it being, like, this instantaneous process, like, there is a little bit of trauma in the, like, sudden flip.
Yeah, I would guess it's, like, a kind of a gray area, like a fade, mm-hmm, sometimes. But, I mean, like I said, I don't know anyone with DID. I really don't have much personal experience with it at all. But you mentioned systems, like, they refer to them as systems. earlier. Like, when you say that, do you mean, like, the person who holds, like, the physical body who holds all these?
The system is the collection of personalities.
It's like the body, basically.
Like No. The system is the communal network of cultures.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So even the home, like, original personality is a member of the system, and they're all active identities that live and coexist within each other. And they have an internal ability, from what I'm gathering, they have an internal ability to communicate, and that's why they're called a system, is because they can't all be out at the same time, but they can cross function.
Right. And they do internally. They do reference that in this movie too. Like, they mention yes. a few times, the psychologist says a few times, you know, they're all sitting in a room with chairs in like a circle or something, and then when it's their turn to kind of have the light, that's when the light, you know, shines on their chair or whatever. I think, like, there are certain things from what you're describing, it seems like they've done some things correctly. And then there is, you know, the OCD stuff. Like, Dennis is the one, is the identity that seems to have OCD. He's always just wiping stuff down before he touches it or after he touches it, moving things around. And, like, that's really, like, the Hollywood, like, representation of obsessive compulsive disorder is, you know, you gotta get things in the right spot. And, you know, it can be so much more or so much less than that on a case-by-case basis. So I think that was fine how they portrayed that. I almost wish that they had just gone with that instead of DID.
So you thought that the OCD part of him was going to be the primary thing about him?
Yes.
A serial killer with OCD?
Yes.
I feel like we've had that before.
I'm sure we have. It's just, that's intriguing to me. He didn't really end up mattering as much. He was really just like kind of a catalyst for the beast, and Patricia was really kind of like acting as the mastermind that was like kind of controlling Dennis to release the beast. So it was this thing where it's like just a little bit of a disappointment for me.
Yeah, and he the beast lives in the train yard, right? That was the whole thing. I think that the thing that bugs me so much, the thing that bugs me so much about the use of DID is it always turns to villainy in a way that is like suggestible to there being something wrong with them that ties in with like the mental aspects of it, because every single personality that we saw like had something about them, like the specificity of their personhood mm-hmm. was so unique to them in a way that people aren't, right? People are not like that in real life. People don't make everything about them their personality. Like, I'm sure even people with OCD don't make every single moment of their life about OCD. And for Dennis, it's a split between he has OCD or he wants to watch girls dance naked. That's his two things, and there's nothing else. For Barry, he only talks about fashion and he's gay, and there's nothing else. For the one that's diabetic, they're diabetic and they can only talk about how they're diabetic. And
well, that's all we see of them.
That's all we see, but if we see what was their video essays, that means that that's all that they talk about.
Well, those were like the introductory video essays, I think, like when he discovered a new...
No.
No?
Because he already had insulin. How would he have insulin if it was his first time as that personality?
Well, I mean, I think it's his first time, like, recording as that personality.
So then why do you have to take insulin? Just switch.
He doesn't have control over it.
Yeah, they do, though. Hedwig has control over it.
Yeah,
and,
but that's...
And it says that they can give the light to the others in the room.
Yeah.
They just... Hedwig chooses not to give the light to any of the other ones. Dennis chooses not to give the light. Patricia chooses not to give the light because they're bad. And they had exiled Patricia and Dennis and Hedwig for being bad, which means that there is choice involved in it, which I don't know if that's true when we're looking at like real to life systems, but it basically just gave them not only like a DID, but it also just gave them every single conglomeration of neuroses possible.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm just like, I get it. You're trying to make an interesting character, but to a point, it becomes too much. Like the guy who only talks about history. It really, at that point, only felt. Yeah, honestly, that's the. He's the monster.
Yeah, really.
It turned into this thing where every single personality in the conglomeration were caricatures. They weren't real people.
Yes.
And when they came forward at the end, even when we weren't in video diary form, when Mr. History Professor takes the light after they call in Kevin, he immediately talks about history. this is your entire personality.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I liked about Identity is that they made them separate people, but they made them separate boring people.
Yeah. It's not like each one had like this really over the top accent or mm-hmm. yeah, it's like you can tell exactly who has the light in any moment
based on the accent,
unless it's Dennis who's acting on like as Barry. And yeah, it's I think that it's hard because how do you do that when you have an audience in mind? You know, how do you do it so that the layman can understand what is going on?
But they did it with clothes.
Yes, but again, then, like, how can you do that? Like, how do we know that it's not, you know, Dennis dressing as Barry, right? Or it's Patricia, or it's I don't know, Hedwig dressing as Patricia, or whatever. I think...
Well, that's the twist.
And people don't notice clothes as much either in... especially in film. So it's...
I think for this one specifically, they do, because James McAvoy comes out wearing a dark maroon turtleneck and a full-length...
That's the most skirt. Notable costume change, though, to be fair.
Besides Hedwig's switch to the yellow the yellow rain jacket, and Barry has the open white t-shirt with the shawl over it, because yeah, gay men wear shawls.
But people wear... different clothes every day. So,
but they don't in this movie.
Not in this movie, but they don't explicitly say it. The character you'll see wearing this outfit is expressly this character. Every time you see him in this outfit, he is this person. So
but
it's
they're telling you that. That's what they're trying to say.
Right, but again, it's not so simple.
In real life, it's not simple.
Right.
In M. Night Shyamalan world, it is that simple. It is that simple.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that they're taking a very complex mental phenomena.
No, that's what I was saying.
Yeah. No, and they're
disagreeing.
No, let me finish. They're taking this complex mental phenomenon that is DID, and they have to simplify it in order for the layman to understand and to get into track with the plot of the movie. I think it has to be that way. And... you know, like I said, I think clothes, yes, that is something that you can use, and they certainly do use, but I think that alone wouldn't be enough for people to really understand and, like, you know, build the tension as much as is necessary for this to be an effective film. So I don't fault M. Night Shyamalan for that necessarily.
Do you fault him for anything?
No, he's perfect. Of course, I liked this movie. I liked it. It had a lot of issues, but I think overall... it was entertaining. Overall, it was tense. It was thrilling. The idea that people with DID are superheroes and can basically make themselves into anything that is as long as they believe that they are that, like the Beast in this case, it's intriguing for sure. And I think, like I said earlier, I think it helps build and enhance upon or build upon and enhance the themes that we see in Unbreakable. It's just not as effective here, I don't think. It just feels kind of like a, what else can I do with this idea kind of thing.
That's also, like, indicative of a little bit of the, because it does try to say, like, oh, parts of DID are good, right? It does try to have that a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other issue in which we fetishize mental illness success. So, for example... in this case, they're like, oh, DID gives you superpowers, and that makes it special and cool. And it's like, don't do that. That's ostracizing in the opposite direction, but it's still ostracizing.
And the one that I was going to bring up, because I think it really connects to Split here, is The Red Dragon. So this is the prequel to Silence of the Lambs. It was the first book with Hannibal Lecter in it. It's the second movie with Hannibal, because they did the second book as a movie first for Silence of the Lambs, and then they did Red Dragon. So The Red Dragon is based on a different serial killer. It's not Buffalo Bill. It's this guy who wants himself to be called The Red Dragon. He's also known as the Tooth Fairy. And if you've seen the movie or read the book, it's pretty good. And there's a lot of similarities between these stories and these themes, where he doesn't have DID, but he convinces himself that his body is housing this red dragon. And it's pretty much what we see with Kevin and the Beast, or Dennis and the Beast. These themes of like, okay, I can become stronger and like, you know, more virile and fierce and almost not human anymore. The red dragon, it's not in a literal sense. Like he becomes like subhuman almost. Like just very animalistic. And in this, he actually becomes, like, they take it much more literally in this movie. So I just see a lot of overlap with this, especially because The Red Dragon was written in the 1970s, I think, and is so much earlier. And like watching this, is especially when we get the Beast at the end, it's like, okay, this is just the Red Dragon. That the Red Dragon was his murderous side to him. And then we kind of get this with the Beast. He's a cannibal, and really we don't see any of the other personalities murder the girls, right? He just eats them when he becomes the Beast.
Correct. So let's talk about the girls.
Okay.
First of all, they handle stuff like an adult, because it starts with them at the party, and Anya Taylor-Joy plays the lead character, but she has been invited to this party by this other girl whose dad is just like, you didn't have to invite her. And the one girl's just like, oh, but like, it would have been really upsetting for her, especially if she was the only person not invited, and I don't know her that well, and I didn't want her to feel left out. And I was like, yeah, good.
That's
good
really
answer.
That's really mature.
That's super mature. Like, good answer. Because you don't know. Fuck, it's, who cares? It's just fine. Like, just invite. It's fine. It didn't cause any issues. So I was like, oh, that's really cool. And they immediately knocked that person out. It's just like, oh, God. And they try to make, like, their sinlessness come off as, like, angry naivete. Like, it wants you to not, the film wants you to not side with them or their plight by just making them a little like naive, and it's like, no, they're and it tries to make Anya Taylor-Joy's character like very much the relatable protagonist, but if you consider their positions,
it's, yeah,
hers is not a position that people would relate to as quickly.
I think it's, yeah, I see what you mean. And it's like they wanted her to be relatable, but also be kind of like the outsider at the same time, which is really hard to do, especially like when they're the main character. So I think that's what the flashbacks were supposed to be like. Oh, like we're slowly revealing her trauma, but also giving you backstory so that you feel connected to this character.
Oh, and Val called her trauma out in her first sentence.
What was her first sentence?
When Dennis is pulling the one girl away, and
right,
she grabs her face and says, pee on yourself. Yeah. And your wife goes,
yeah, she could have spoken like someone who's been sexually abused.
And then we immediately knew what happened.
I mean, you also get kind of like hints of that even like when they're at the restaurant or the party or whatever you want to call it, like when they're at that setting, like she's calling to get a ride home or whatever, and someone's not answering, and so you get the impression that her family situation is not great. So
I don't think that she ever really called. I think that she was trying to get out of having to go back, because that kind of becomes a significant theme throughout the film, is she doesn't actually want to go back home.
Yeah, that's why she gets detention after school. And
yeah, and so I think that she was just like, oh, nobody picked up, so I guess I'll just walk, which means, hey, I don't have to go home. And then the dad's like, oh, no, we'll give you a ride. I insist. And and you're not going to be like, no, I don't want to. And especially because M. Night Shyamalan paints this character as one who just allows bad things to continue happening, which
like at the very
we
end.
All know is you know, the whole point of the film is, like, you're supposed to be thinking that she's getting stronger and is able to accept it because she's being sexually abused by her uncle. And then it like, builds up to this thing, like, she's gonna say something and she's gonna put a stop to it. And then, nope, it doesn't. He's just like, ah, the uncle's there to pick her up. Well, guess she's going back with him now. And it's like, fuck you, M. Night Shyamalan.
Well,
no.
And so I haven't seen Glass, but you said she comes back in Glass, right?
Yeah, but it's, like, at the very end of Glass.
Okay, so there's not, like, any kind of resolution there. Me knowing that Glass is a thing, I was like, ah, I'll probably, you know, fix that in Glass, but I guess not. So I'm allowed, we're allowed to be upset about that.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I'd like to talk a little bit about cinematography too in this, because I think they do that very well. Because obviously
that I do agree with. I will say that it is shot very nicely.
That and some interesting sound design things. Sound design, probably not the greatest we've seen by far, but there are certain things that are done really well. So for cinematography, you know, we're talking about Casey and her flashbacks. I liked that recurring shot that we got from behind the hunting rifle when. So that first happens when Casey's dad is aiming at the buck that they're hunting. And then again, when Casey is, like, young Casey is aiming the gun at her uncle.
Yep.
And that is kind of like this, the predator becoming the prey motif that happens. This happens. Like, yeah, it's like you're just like, do it! Because you hate his guts at that point and you know what's going on. But there is this motif of, like, predator and prey in this movie, especially considering, you know, the beast persona. And then the whole fact that they're in a zoo, and the fact that the beast needs to feed on people, the sacred food that these girls are. So there is that kind of idea, and then also, like, the idea of a sexual predator, right? That's what we call them. There were also those kind of, like, symmetrical shots that happened a lot that often had some kind of line dividing it. Pretty much down the middle. So it's like, that's the name of the movie is Split, right? So it's a split shot. We get a really good one when it's first showing, like, their cell, that crack in the wall right down the middle, which is, like, super cool.
M. Night Shyamalan makes good cinematographic choices. The issue is, I think that sometimes the stories get a little ahead of themselves. Like, there's good shots, good color palette, good use of, like, scenes. In general, shot composition, attention to detail within the actual scenes, I think is always really good. It was good in Signs, it was good in The Village. What is lacking is care placed in the telling of the story, for me.
And to some degree, the actual writing of the story. I think he would do really well if he directed a movie that someone else wrote. You know,
I think so too.
That's allowed. Has anyone ever told them that? That's allowed. Yeah, like I said, I think it's a good movie. It is problematic, though.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This was Matt.
What? Don't say was.
Thank you, everyone, and listening for this. Thanks.
Sorry, mess you up. That just upset me. Sorry.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of Watch No Evil. This is Matt.
And this is Zach.
And remember, folks, there's no use crying over split milk.
That's a good one.